Dat alles veroorzaakt een gevoel van malaise in de westerse publieke opinie. Dat geldt zowel voor de Nederlandse media als de internationale pers. In de Nederlandse pers wordt geprobeerd vorm te geven aan de sombere vooruitzichten van de Oekraïnse krijgskant. Van veel kritische evaluatie, introspectie of hand in eigen boezem van het westerse beleid of de eigen rol van de pers is nog geen sprake. De teneur is wel kritisch op de eigen regering die Oekraïne te laat en te weinig bewapend zou hebben. Ook worden verwijten gemaakt aan de beperkingen die Oekraïne worden opgelegd bij het gebruik van de soorten wapens. Het beleid was er een van geremde escalatie. De remmen werden aangebracht om de oorlog niet te laten escaleren naar de landen van de NAVO zelf of naar Rusland. Hoewel de remmen in de loop van het afgelopen jaar zijn gevierd, heeft dat Oekraïne niet aan een doorbraak of een overwinning geholpen. De heersende stemming is om meer wapens aan Oekraïne te blijven geven, maar een kritische beschouwing over welke strategie daarmee gediend is, wordt niet gemaakt. Het gaat net als in het begin van de oorlog om niet gespecificeerde angsten voor een Russische opmars. En hoe reëel die angsten zijn en welke methoden het best gepast zijn om een dergelijk gevaar af te wenden, is geen onderwerp van bespreking. Zelensky ondertussen is de afgelopen week alweer naar de VS geweest, omdat hij een steunpakket van 60 miljard dollar moet zien te redden. Met pep talk als dat Poetin moet verliezen, wordt de zaak opgepompt. Biden had de hulppakketten voor Oekraïne en Israël gekoppeld. De reden daarvoor was dat bij afzonderlijke voorstellen het Oekraïnepakket waarschijnlijk zou mislukken door de trompistische vleugel in de Republikeinse fractie in de Senaat. Nu heeft ook onafhankelijk lid Bernie Sanders tegen het totaalpakket gestemd vanwege de Israëlische genocidale politiek. En of Zelensky er in Amerika in slaagt de miljarden binnen te harken, is op dit moment van schrijven nog onzeker. Als het mislukt, is de penibele militaire situatie gecombineerd met het wegvallen van de belangrijkste politieke en financiële steun en dan wordt het paniek. De Britse krant The Guardian noemde als enige, bij mijn weten, het verschijnsel onderhandelingen en zei erbij dat het Oekraïne is dat beslist of er onderhandeld zou moeten worden. Die opvatting is niet nieuw, maar is amper te herkennen in het pessimistische koor. Het was Jaap de Hoop Scheffer die een zeer concreet voorstel deed en het niet van Oekraïne laat afhangen. Hij wil onderhandelen met Rusland. Oud-NAVO-baas en ex-minister van Buitenlandse Zaken Jaap de Hoop Scheffer deed afgelopen zondag 10 december op tv Buitenhof een voorstel tot onderhandelen met Rusland. Hij bepleitte twee dingen. 1. Het inroepen van een verkenner, zo noem ik het maar, en dat is een zwaar gewicht, in de woorden van de Hoop Scheffer, die bij Rusland peilt wat de vooruitzichten zijn voor het eind van de oorlog. India noemde hij letterlijk bij naam, maar dat land mag van hem geen bemiddelaar worden genoemd. Het is wel degelijk een boodschapper die tot nu toe niet gezocht werd door het Westen. En het is ook een zwaktepot van het Westen dat de nieuwe verhoudingen in de wereld tot uitdrukking brengt. Het Westen kan het zelf niet als partij in deze oorlog, maar zoekt de uitweg elders. Van India is niet bekend of ze akkoord is. En 2, de Hoop Scheffer droeg ook het plan van Rasmussen uit. Dat is ook een oud NAVO-baas om Oekraïne lid te maken van de NAVO, maar zonder de door Rusland bezette gebieden. En na staakt het vuur werd er terloops bijgezegd door de Hoop Scheffer. Een dergelijk voorstel is beslist een vorm van onderhandelen, zoals al in oktober in de Ukraine Defense Group werd vastgesteld en zoals officieel hevig ontkend wordt. Ik noemde dit voorstel van Rasmussen 4 weken geleden een proefballon, maar nu wordt het met kracht door een paar ex-NAVO-leiders naar voren geschoven. Een deel van Oekraïne lidmaken van de NAVO betekent ook het risico op deelname aan de oorlog tussen Oekraïne en Rusland door het Westen. Hoe terloops ook de opmerking na een staakt het vuren. Het is een wanhopig plan waarbij de Oekraïnse territoriale doelen van april 2022, namelijk het heroveren van de Donbass en de Krim, zijn verlaten voor een NAVO-lidmaatschap voor het resterende deel van het land. Het lokkertje van het NAVO-lidmaatschap lijkt vooral bedoeld om Oekraïne tot territoriale toegevingen aan Rusland te bewegen en de oorlog zo spoedig mogelijk te beëindigen. Maar Rusland zal niet meewerken aan een Oekraïns lidmaatschap van de NAVO. Dat is althans mijn veronderstelling op basis van 16 jaar zeer heftig te noemen verzet tegen zo'n lidmaatschap. Als het op onderhandelen aankomt, bijvoorbeeld met behulp van India, dan zullen de resultaten van de onderhandelingen in Istanbul in maart 2022, een maand na het begin van de oorlog, het uitgangspunt worden, als het aan Rusland ligt. En daarin was een neutraal Oekraïne overeengekomen. Voor minder zal Rusland het op dit moment niet doen. Het voorstel van de hoofdscheffer werd verpakt met een hoop ideologische draging over Trump, Poetin, Orbán en Wilders, maar het was het enige openbaar besproken plan dat een concreet antwoord op de huidige situatie geeft. Dat brengt me tot het slot. De toestand van de bevolking van Oekraïne is ernstig en plannen om Oekraïne te stutten hebben alleen zin als er een staakt het vuur overeen wordt gekomen. Dat was kennelijk ook het plan van de Ukraine Defense Group in oktober. Of daaraan in stilte wordt gewerkt, kunnen we alleen hopen. De bedreigingen voor de bevolking van Oekraïne zijn nog het grootst.
Guido van Leemput met zijn blik op de oorlog was dat. En hiermee is ook Patapoeseriasje met je entree weer eens afgelopen. Bedankt voor het luisteren en de mensen die mee hebben gedaan, bedankt voor het meedoen. Volgende week zijn we er vast ook weer. Dus tot de volgende week dan maar. Daag.
Lichtjahre, dann bin ich da, wo ich bin. Denn ich bin lang nicht mehr da. Gestorben an einer Überdosis Zeit. Und die Sekunde ist meine Heimat. In der Terz wohnt der Lichtjahre sind es bis zur Gegenwart, sagte mir der alte Methusalem. Denn da feiern sie, so sagt er, die Hochzeit von Licht und Zeit. Soll sie sich beeilen, die Zeit, denn ich freue mich auf unsere Vermählung. We'll be right back. ein wenig kalt am Wendepunkt der Welt. Aber ich habe Zeit zu warten, bis Mittwoch auf Sonntag fällt.
Thank you. Airing on Asheville FM 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagee land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week, we're pre-sharing a conversation with Claire Fullman, a writer, activist, and gardener with a master's in environmental science, about her 2026 AK Press book, Scapegoat, What the Invasive Species Story Gets Wrong. This conversation covers questions of ecological balance, belonging, linguistic clarity, and the story that we tell about our relationship to the rest of nature.
Will you introduce yourself with your name, pronouns if you'd like, and any other information about yourself that you would like listeners to know?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Claire Fullman. I use she, her pronouns. And then this is just the bio I've been using, and I think it's pretty good, so I'm just going to share it. I am an author and environmentalist located in Olympia, Washington. My writing engages with themes of ecology, language, politics, and philosophy. I like to poke holes in dominant or obsolete narratives and strive to both listen to and help uplift the voices and stories that have been too often cast aside, including those from the more than human world. My work focuses on finding and planting the literal and figurative seeds that will help support a post-capitalist society that prioritizes the well-being of people and planet.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
So we're here to talk about your recent book called Scapegoat, What the Invasive Species Story Gets Wrong. In this book, you blend a discussion of language use with those of environmentalism, politics, and a critique of quote-unquote invasive species management. Will you talk about the confluence of all these and how you arrived at this intersection of ideas?
Yeah, and I'll just start with the language piece because I think that's one part of my book that people are really split on. Some people love how much time I spend like talking about the way in which language functions to shape how we see ourselves and the world around us. And other people are really like, why is this in an environmental or ecology book? And so, yeah, just to speak a little bit about that. So invasive species management as a discipline, if you explore it and research it to any depth, you're going to find such a heavy critique of the language that is used to discuss invasive species, because the definitions are slippery, but also there's this obvious xenophobic undertone when talking about invasive species and species that are coming into new spaces that don't belong here, alien and exotic or other synonyms that are used to talk about invasive species. So aside from the, you know, the inherent racism embedded in this sort of discussion, there's also just like these words are very confusing and there's so much discussion on how to clarify and pin down these definitions that are quite slippery. So that's why I really wanted to focus on language, because you know it's just such a common critique of invasive species management. And I felt that to really engage in the conversation and contribute in meaningful ways, I really wanted to focus on how words work. So I really do focus a lot of time on semiotics and linguistics. But all that aside, what really got me started on exploring and critiquing invasive species management as it is performed today, you know, the most popular ways it is performed today, I was actually in a prerequisite course for my my master's of environmental studies class. And we had it was on forest ecology. And we had this guest speaker named Lowell Diller, who was an ornithologist and wildlife biologist, come to talk to our class about the work he was doing, which at the time involved killing the barred owl to save the spotted owl. And so some context, the barred owl is considered invasive where I live in the Pacific Northwest. It originates in the eastern side of the continent, and it moved and migrated to the Pacific Northwest because as colonizers finally settled the continent, they created two routes, two pathways for the barred owl to move west. They violently suppressed controlled birding practices of the indigenous people and also extirpated beaver and bison. And this allowed the boreal forests of Canada to grow and created these little pockmarked oasis green spaces in the Great Plains. And so that allowed the barred owl to move west, where the spotted owl was also facing side effects of colonization, namely logging was destroying spotted owl habitat. Spotted owl is a native species to the Pacific Northwest and requires great swaths of old growth forest to thrive. And so obviously logging was destroying old growth forest. And so when the barred owl moved to the Pacific Northwest, it did compete to a degree with spotted owl, to be sure. It eats what the spotted owl eats. It lives where but it can eat other things as well. It lives where the spotted owl lives, but it can live other places as well. And it also has more nestlings per season. And so anyway, so Lowell Diller was doing this experiment to see if killing the barred owl would save the spotted owl. It was a plan to kill about 3,000 barred owls at the time. And when he came to talk to our class, he had killed, I think, 70. And I think what really like struck me, other than like this story is just such a, it has like these undertones of like a Greek tragedy, especially since the birds look very, very similar, but just like what struck me about this story was Lowell Diller himself was stricken, like heartbroken to kill the barred owl. He had spent his whole career learning to revere raptors, and now he had to be their executioner. And he wasn't shy to talk about his anguish. And he shared that, you know, the first day he had to go kill one, he had a breakdown. And so I think that really struck me. And he also said this thing. He said, like, I hate to do it. I hate to kill barred owls, but it's the best plan we have available to saving the spotted owl. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't know. I mean, you're the expert. You probably know better than I do. You certainly know better than I do about this. But I wonder if there is a better plan available. And so that's really what started my interest in exploration in invasive species management. And during my research, I actually found a lot of plot holes, you know, in the general invasive species management story, but also specifically Lowell Diller's story. And so this is kind of where the intersection of like of politics and language and story and all that come to play. Because what's so interesting about the barred owl slaughter story is that, you know, Lowell Diller, at the time of performing this experiment, he was actually employed by a timber company, a mega timber company in the Pacific Northwest. And a little more context, you know, when the spotted owl was put on the endangered species list, environmentalists and activists were rallying against loggers and the timber company for, you know, being the main contributor to spotted owl decline. And so there was this like long kind of nasty battle between them with tree sits and tree spikes and rumors of spotted owl barbecues and t-shirts that said, save an owl, you know, save a logger, eat an owl. And so it's quite telling, I think, that after that like big, you know, battle between environmentalists and logger, Lowell Diller, employed by a mega timber company, was encouraged and funded to engage in this experiment to see if barred owls actually could be proven to be contributing to spotted owl decline. And so I think this is really like, I think this is the key story that I really like sharing about, you know, the point of my book is that I think that, you know, I'm arguing that the barred owl is scapegoated and we are distracted by the, you know, the invasive species management projects of slaughtering the barred owl. Meanwhile, logging is able to continue wrecking havoc and contributing to habitat destruction as long as, you know, we are focused our efforts on killing the barred owl to save the planet. And so, I guess. So yeah, that's kind of the original story that got me really interested in this particular topic. And then as I continued researching, I found more and more plot holes and issues with this story that really created this very compelling scapegoat narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. Like as a kind of outsider to that story, it's strange to me that would be the solution that you would land on, especially for something that you love that much, that the solution is we need to kill it. So one of the things you talk about in your book quite a bit is that militaristic language and tactics are used heavily to interface with and to describe invasive species. Can you talk a little bit more about the current understanding of invasive species and kind of when and how did this come to be, and then also like ways we talk about these species and these animals?
Yeah, absolutely. So invasion biology, this like discipline that like points out these particular species that may be contributing to an unbalanced ecosystem. This has been a study and discipline for quite a while, but it didn't really gain popularity until right after World War II. And this author, Charles Elton, wrote in his book, I think it's called The Invasion by Plants and Animals or something like that. And this book is just absolutely full of militaristic and war metaphor. And so what's also interesting, I think, is as it was gaining in popularity and then burst with popularity in this post-war era, the Nazis before World War II were very, very obsessed with the idea of invasive species management. And it obviously had a lot of parallels to their bigoted xenophobic perspectives. And some of the studies and ways in which they classified and organized invasive species informed.
Een actuele Patapou-reportage. In samenwerking met Centech Produteam Amsterdam Internationaal en Lutjes High Profitable.
Airing on Asheville FM, 103.3 LPFM in Asheville. This
spotted owl eats. It lives where but it can eat other things as well. It lives where the spotted owl lives, but it can live other places as well. And it also has more nestlings per season. And so anyway, so Lowell Diller was doing this experiment to see if killing the barred owl would save the. And we are distracted by the invasive species management projects of slaughtering the barred owl. Meanwhile, logging is able to continue wrecking havoc and contributing to habitat destruction as long as, you know, we are focused our efforts on killing the barred owl to save the planet. And so I guess, so yeah, that's kind of the original story that got me really interested in this particular topic. And then as I continued researching, I found more and more plot holes and issues with this story that really created this can be absolutely harmless metaphors and non-problematic metaphors. But, you know, when used in disciplines like science and disciplines that organize how you understand yourself and the world around you, there are certain metaphors that can be problematic. But I'll give an example of like a non-problem metaphor to help illustrate why the militaristic metaphor is so problematic when it comes to talking about invasive species. So like a non-problem metaphor in science is like there's this billiard ball model of molecules, and it gets at the idea that molecules bounce off of one another like billiard balls. But it's a non-problem metaphor because we don't actually think of molecules as if they're like fist-sized colored balls with numbers on them. So it's easy to disentangle the metaphor from the fact. Whereas in medicine and invasive species management, it's actually a lot harder to disentangle the militaristic perspective from what is actually happening. And this there was a study done where these scientists and doctors were interviewed about their perspective on the use of the militaristic metaphor when talking about the immune system. And a lot of the doctors and scientists who were interviewed were like, it's not a metaphor. That's actually just how it is. But in fact, you know, in microorganisms and invasive species, these are, organisms, these are species, these are creatures that cannot engage in war by any stretch of the imagination. That is an anthropogenic activity. And, you know, invasive species, they are, what they're doing is they are, you know, they were brought into a new place by people and they are trying to live. That's all they're doing. They may be very well suited to the area and thrive very well and destabilize ecosystems, but there's no war that's happening. But the thing is, because the melargistic metaphor is so hard to disentangle from what's happening, and it's easy to look at an ecosystem and see invasive species and think, oh no, it's polluting the genetic and or the, like the integrity, the pristine utopian native habitat. It's invading. It's, you know, it's mercilessly slaughtering all the native species. It's a colonizer. It is easy to see these species and have that metaphor be very persuasive. And so, you know, aside from the metaphor being hard to disentangle from what is actually happening, it's also, it fuels some like problematic mythologies, especially when you're talking about the natural world. So it has this like inherent hierarchy that people are like above nature and can command and control nature in some capacity, or should command and control nature in some capacity. It also has the sort of us versus them, or creates this us versus them mentality. And I think the like the biggest issue is that it's like sort of predicated on this belief that people and the natural world are separate entities. And so, and I think that's one of the biggest, like the most problematic mythologies of capitalism for ecological care. So it fuels like, you know, because the militaristic metaphor is so persuasive and it's so villainizing, it creates a very biased and aggressive mentality and engagement with these particular species that I think is also like a very problem way of thinking about any aspect of the natural world, especially today. And so that's like the main metaphor that is used when we talk about invasive species, and it's very popular, it's very persuasive, and I think it is biased, and it is missing nuance that would help inform a better way of ecological repair.
Yeah, this is also kind of an aside, but have you found that there's a lot of pushback in the scientific community, or like any pushback in the scientific community to this language and way of talking about things?
Yeah, you know, like I said earlier, like the language used to talk about invasive species is like the number one critique. You know, Charles Elton with his original militaristic metaphor that just informed like rampant popular discourse about invasive species. It's like the number one critique of how people talk about invasive species. And there's, you know, discussion of different terms and phrases to use to sort of decrease or combat the militaristic metaphor, to use a militaristic metaphor to talk about militaristic metaphors. And actually, and if I may share, there's this one metaphor that's gaining some popularity that I like a lot better than the militaristic metaphor, because it really helps ground the root cause of ecological issues that exist beyond invasive species. And this is the passenger driver metaphor, or the passenger driver model of talking about invasive species. So the passenger driver metaphor basically gets at the idea that invasive species can be either passengers or drivers of ecological degradation or issues. But studies and research are showing that by and large, these invasive species are not driving the ecological issues that they are being blamed for, but rather are arriving in the wake of pre-existing conditions of ecological damage and degradation that is being driven by some other system, something else. And so, you know, we can go back to the barred owl, spotted owl example. The barred owl is arriving in pre-existing conditions of ecological degradation due to logging that is negatively impacting spotted owl habitat and other native species habitat, and is just trying to survive while spotted owl decrease. Another example, in California, there's this ecosystem where there's this invasive grass that grows really well in this ecosystem. And it's because the ecosystem has very nitrogen rich soil. And the thing is that the soil hasn't always been nitrogen rich. It only became nitrogen rich after they built a highway next to the ecosystem, and the air pollution from the highway increased the availability of nitrogen in the soil, while also decreasing the ecosystem's resilience, the native ecosystem's resilience. And these two situations were the conditions that allow this invasive grass that was brought here by people to grow and spread and thrive. And I have to interrupt myself again because my cat is meowing.
One thing I would be interested if you could expand on a little bit more, which you talked about in the book, was kind of the way this militaristic approach affects the way people choose to quote unquote like manage invasive species. and that often the destruction of habitats that have had invasive species in them, like, to put it succinctly, is like pretty terrible for everyone involved mm-hmm. that live there. Could you expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah. So as I was saying, you know, like, I think the militaristic metaphor really fuels this very like tunnel vision bias, like aggressive hatred of a particular group of species who, you know, who I argue are innocent victims of colonization and or capitalism, but are, you know, in many cases, certainly contributing negatively to the ecosystem or destabilizing the ecosystem to some degree, or, you know, infringing upon native species. However, there are studies that show, you know, and I was kind of blown away by this study too, but there was a study that shows that the removal of one invasive species in an ecosystem at a time always resulted in a negative effect on the rest of the ecosystem and the native species in that ecosystem, or something to that effect, so it's basically getting at the idea that, you know, these species in these ecosystems, invasive or not, are extremely deeply entangled with one another. They have these relationships, even if, you know, in certain cases with invasive species, those relationships are not as beneficial to or reciprocal as one would want. But they still have these relationships, and it's never just a cut and dry, this species is all like only doing harm to this particular habitat, because ecosystems are so complex. And there's this example of a habitat near where I live that was slated for development. And it was a habitat that had a lot of herons. It had a heron rookery in it. And a bunch of people gathered together to try to stop this development from happening. And they were successful. And then saving the habitat made them feel, I think, a sense of responsibility to care for the habitat and tend to the land. And so they went in to do some invasive species management removal, specifically removing English ivy, which is an invasive species where I live, or considered an invasive species where I live. And so, you know, a bunch of neighbors pulled this ivy out of the habitat and the herons left. And so the thinking is that, you know, of course, English ivy, it grows abundantly. It outcompetes a lot of ground cover native species like wild ginger and starflower and bleeding heart and whatever. But it also, in this particular case, created a really beneficial and attractive habitat, sense of cover specifically for the herons, because the herons would have their babies and the ivy created this camouflage, this cover. And so the herons felt less exposed when the ivy was there. This is what the common thinking goes. And so then when the ivy was removed, the herons felt too exposed and they left and they moved away. So yes, English ivy is outcompeting certain species. And at the same time, it is also in this particular case, benefiting the heron. And so it just really goes to show how interconnected and how complex the relationships that species have in ecosystems, native, non-native, invasive.
Yeah.
Een actuele patapoe reportage. Samenwerking met Semtech Produteam Amsterdam Internationaal en Lutjes High Profi Tepel.
Is this thing on? Can you hear me now?
In Duitsland mogen de voetballers dan wel beginnen aan hun toernooi. Wij scoren hier vanavond zeker de mooiste doelpunten, want er waren ook deze week weer heel wat coole nieuwe nummers te vinden. Goedenavond en welkom bij Signaal Ruis. We starten snedig met het Australische Favorite State. De band uit Melbourne heeft net hun debuut-EP It's a Mess uit. De titel zegt al veel en textueel gaat het vooral over de angstcultuur, maatschappelijke desillusies en het huidige politieke klimaat. Dat klinkt wel heel bekend. Favorite State met That's Life.
That's Life van Favorite State. Postpunk uit Melbourne, uiteraard gemasterd door Mikey Young. Het Rotterdamse kwartet Neighbors Burning Neighbors brengt in september hun debuutalbum uit bij Subroutine Records. De opnames zijn al een tijdje achter de rug. De eerste single eruit, Neil Young, die kennen we al. En nu krijgen we een tweede voorsmaakje. Dit is A Familiar Place van Neighbors Burning Neighbors.